Welcome, I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and this is a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Thank you for joining us for a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast, now on Mental Health News Radio Network. This podcast is also available wherever you get your podcasts, but I do suggest checking out Mental Health News Radio Network to find all your podcasts related to mental health. Today's guest is Jennifer Chesick. Jennifer is the author of The Psilocybin Handbook for Women, How Magic Mushrooms, Psychedelic Therapy, and Microdosing Can Benefit Your Mental, Physical, and Spiritual Health. She is also an adjunct instructor at Belmont University, where she teaches courses in journalism. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. So I want to know, where did you come up with the idea of creating this handbook, the Psilocybin Handbook for Women, and why did you feel like you were the person to write it?
Great question. So I actually can't take credit for the entire idea. It was my publisher's idea to do a book on psilocybin specifically for women. But diving into it, I was so excited to take this on. And I think I was the right person for the job because I have this huge background in medical and science journalism. And then I have been writing about psychedelics for a little while in a journalism context for different publications. And so just bridging the two of, you know, I have such a fascination with women's health because I've had a lot of medical problems myself. And I feel like the mainstream medical system often leaves women behind in terms of conditions that they're facing, and they don't take their symptoms seriously quite often. And so I'm so passionate about forwarding women's health. And so then also just bridging the two, it seems like we really needed a book out there. There's tons of books out there on psychedelics in general, but we really needed a book that addressed how does psilocybin affect the menstrual cycle and can it help with menopause? All of these facets that really intersect with women's health.
Oh, I definitely want to get into that. But what got you into psychedelics in general?
I've always really been interested in psychedelics, but I had a lot of fear surrounding doing them myself. I was worried about having a bad experience or having sort of a medical issue while on psychedelics, because again, I do have very many physical health problems. And so I was really worried about that and very hesitant. And so I had never done them myself. And then when I got the book deal, I was like, well, I have got to do mushrooms because I can't accurately write about mushrooms unless I've had a personal experience. And I'm so glad that I did. I'm so glad I took the leap because it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. So always fascinated by psychedelics, but always scared of them. And then now I have no more fear about psychedelics. I think they're amazing. They're helping so many people. And I'm so excited to spread the word about that and to help take some of that fear out of it for other people.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So was your first journey a big journey, or did you just start microdosing?
I did a macrodose as my first, leap into psychedelics. I just wanted the full experience. And then I've since done a microdosing as well. And yeah, it's been great. Everything's been wonderful.
How has psychedelics changed your life? I mean, obviously you wrote this book and that also changes your life, but psychedelics, just how was that taking it, and what have you seen, the benefits that you've seen?
Yeah, so many benefits. I think one of the biggest benefits for me was, and this is something that occurred during my macrodose, and I've since been integrating it, but I've always had a lot of anxiety in, I would say, the past 10 years about eventually losing my parents. So I'm 45, I'm in middle age, and my parents are around 80, you know, and so they're getting up there in years. They've had some health problems, and I help with a lot of their care. I help manage their care. And so it feels like sometimes I know too much, and which is a good thing. I'm glad I do. But that can also give me a lot of anxiety about, okay, well, eventually I will lose my parents, as we all do. It's a fact of life, but it's not something that we often talk about in society, that we're struggling with this anxiety regarding this. And so, again, always had a lot of anxiety around it. And then during my journey, the mushroom essentially forced me to look at that. Like, why do you have such anxiety about it? And I've had anxiety because it seems like I won't be able to get through it, the eventual loss of them. And it just seems like it's going to be this dark black hole on the other side of never ending grief, and that will be the rest of my life.
No.
And it's sort of an absurd thing when you think, when I say it out loud, it sounds absurd, but that's what was going on in my brain. And so during my macro dose, it was like the mushroom forced me to look at that. And it was an uncomfortable feeling for a little bit there, but I sat with it. And I'm so glad that I did, because it was like the mushroom showed me all of the difficult things I've gotten through previously in my life and
Wow.
showed me that I do have the tools to cope with difficult things. Plus, I have this amazing support system that I can tap into to lean on during a difficult time. I'm not going to be walking through it alone. Yes, it will be my own grief, but I will have people to help hold me up and hold my hand through it. And I just didn't really feel that before, and now I do. And so on the other side of that journey, as I was kind of sort of coming down from the psilocybin peak dose there, I had this amazing peace and euphoria. I can't even describe it. It was the most peace I've ever felt in my life, just knowing I'm going to be okay. So that has been probably one of the biggest things that has really changed me after doing psilocybin. But other things I've noticed are I've really cut back on drinking. It's not that I had a drinking problem before, but I certainly was always reaching for that glass of wine around dinner time, would have like one or two glasses. And now I'm just like not even thinking about it. Yeah, I might still have one here and there, but it's not a constant thing. And so I've really cut back on that. And I'm sleeping better. I used to always have insomnia, and now I'm really managing that so much better. And so just little things like that have been good behavior changes that I've really felt have been profound. And then of course that reduction in that anxiety regarding my parents.
Wow, that's amazing. I love being able to come out of and listen to other people's stories coming out of a macro dose and seeing like real change happening. And I think it's fascinating that you had this fear that you didn't you this fear of taking psychedelics. I'm curious what your thoughts are, what you would talk to other people about if they said, I'm just too scared to do it. I'd want to do it, but I'm too scared to do it.
Yeah, I think the things I want to convey are that anything you've seen on TV in terms of like you've watched in a movie or a TV show where someone is tripping on something, that's not what it's like. I
Right.
mean, sure, yeah, there are some visuals and things like that, but you're not like out of your mind. You know who you are for the most part, unless you do perhaps a heroic dose, you might lose more of your sense of self. But in a normal general macro dose, it's not as scary as it seems like, or it's made out to be on like TV and film. And then also that any concept you've had about psychedelics that was portrayed during the war on drugs, put that out of your mind, because it's all misinformation and disinformation, and that's just not the way it is either. And then I think the other thing that people do have a lot of fear about having a bad experience. And yes, bad trips do happen, but most people who've had a bad experience, we know through research now that we want to call them challenging experiences instead of bad experiences, because people still report, even if they've had a difficult trip, that it's one of the most profound things they've ever experienced. They rate it in the top 5 or top 10 of the most profound things, rating up there with the birth of a child or a
Yeah.
wedding, things like that. So I think it's important to consider that even if you do have a challenging moment come up during your journey, it may be very profound. And the other thing to remember too is that if you go into it with an open mind and just being open to the experience and letting it unfold and trying to keep yourself calm, you likely won't have a bad experience. It's when people put up that resistance to
Yes.
it, to the experience, that's when what research shows is where people have more difficult journeys. So just trying to convey those things and take some of the disinformation out of it.
Yeah, I do feel that when you do resist, when you do resist that challenging experience, there's a reason why I feel the mushroom is, or any psychedelic, it's showing you something that you need to face, something that you need to really examine. And if you're being resistant, then there's no way. It's just you're just running from something, right? You're going to constantly be running from it. And I think that's why you know, a lot of researchers are saying integration, preparation is so important. Because if you need to be okay with seeing the most difficult parts of your life, I think, you know, I always say, like, you're really diving deep into your soul. And sometimes you'll have to run into some of the darkest parts of your soul. And that's when, like, you're shining light on it, and it can actually be so beautiful. So I absolutely, I'm with you with the whole, it's not a bad experience unless, as you know, some people have said, like, oh, well, if you're buying like mushrooms online, or like you don't know where you're getting your stuff from, you could have a bad experience because it might not be what it's they say it is. So I say,
right,
make sure you know where your stuff is coming from.
Of course.
Right. And then preparation. I think preparation is everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That setting and then the integration are so important. Yes.
So absolutely. Important. So now I want to delve into the whole microdosing for women. Like, I love that because, you know, I personally, I struggle with PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, just through my own trauma as a childhood sexual abuse survivor. And I feel like a lot of people deal with that too, but there's not enough research out there. I feel like, no, we're not exploring that more. But how does microdosing or even macrodosing help with your menstrual cycle and all the things that come with it?
Yes, I love talking about this part because the research is so fascinating. So we're just starting out with research on this, but some researchers out of Johns Hopkins, Dr. Natalie Gukasian and Dr. Sasha K. Narayan, they've done some case studies to see how do psychedelics potentially affect the menstrual cycle. And it looks like they do potentially affect the menstrual cycle, but to beneficial effects, which is good news. You know, again, we need more research, and these are just case studies so far. But there are sort of three things that likely happen with or have the potential to happen with the menstrual cycle with macrodosing, but also with microdosing. So the case studies were with macrodoses, but people reported that their menstrual cycle came a little early, meaning they got their period a little earlier than expected. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing was a return to regularity after a time of irregular menstrual cycles. And then the other thing, the final thing, was that some people who had an absence of a period, not because of menopause, but just for other random reasons, maybe it was stress, mm-hmm. they had an absence of a period for a while and their periods returned after doing a macrodose. So that was really exciting to hear, because I do see a lot of potential for psilocybin to help with conditions that are related to the menstrual cycle. So you mentioned having premenstrual dysphoric disorder. One of the women that was in the case studies had PMDD as well. Another one had polycystic ovarian syndrome, so PCOS. And then, you know, I myself, just to bring up another condition, and this is not a sole menstrual cycle condition, it affects the entire body, but I have endometriosis. And so I see potential here to help with these conditions, or perhaps even fertility. And people always want to know, well, what are the possible mechanisms? Why would taking a psychedelic do anything to the menstrual cycle? Well, our menstrual cycle occurs along what's called the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. So what I mean by that is when our menstrual cycles are doing their whole trajectory, where we have the follicular phase and we have ovulation, and then we have the luteal phase, and then we get our periods. Mm-hmm. That all occurs because as one hormone kicks off, it tells another hormone what to do, and our brains are communicating with our ovaries in this sort of complex feedback loop. And so that occurs along that axis. And then we also have another axis in our bodies called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And this controls our stress response. And so when we use psilocybin, we are activating our serotonin receptors along that HPA axis. And so you can tell by their names, the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that these two axes overlap with the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not a stretch to think that since they overlap, that one would impact the other. And we already know this from science, that if we have, or we just know from our general lives, if we have some extra stress, sometimes that stops our period, right?
Yeah.
Or if we are if we're on our periods, we or getting close to getting them, we can become more stressed, right? And so that
Right.
impacts our stress response as well. So we know just through other, you know, research that these axes do have an interplay. And so it's not a stretch to assume that by using psilocybin or another psychedelic, when we're activating that stress response, it with beneficial effects, it may have beneficial effects on the menstrual cycle. So I was really excited to learn that. And so I
Wow.
talked to, you know, obviously when we talk about psilocybin or and other psychedelics, but especially psilocybin, it's important to bring in indigenous wisdom because, you know, indigenous communities have used psilocybin for, you know, thousands of years and well before like someone like me got my hands on it. And so it's so important to bring that in because we think of science as a process of doing things over and over again to reproduce the same results. But that's exactly what indigenous communities have been doing. And they've had these practices around the menstrual cycle in terms of where you are in your cycle when you use psilocybin. And so I did talk to an indigenous wisdom expert and she had some really great advice surrounding when we use psilocybin for our menstrual cycle. So if you are doing a macro dose, she recommends doing that when you're closer to ovulation rather than when you're getting closer to your period. And there's actually like, this is all rooted in science too, in that, this makes total sense. So as we get closer to our menstrual to menstruation, our bodies have less energy available to us. And that's because when I talk about like energy, I'm talking about like glucose metabolism and things like that. That's all being shuttled towards the womb, and which makes sense, of course, because, you know, there's the potential for a baby, right?
Right,
so,
right.
That makes sense. And then, but when we're closer to ovulation, we have a lot of more energy and we are, metabolism is much more efficient during the ovulation phase. So that's why she recommends that. Plus, a lot of people do fast as we before going into a psilocybin journey, and that may be fasting just for a few hours, or it might be a full day. You know, people have different practices, which is totally fine. But that's a little less accessible to you as you're in your luteal phase. It's much more accessible as you're closer to ovulation, and again, that has to do with our energy metabolism, and it explains why we, as we get closer to our periods, we often have cravings and things like that. It's because we become much more insulin resistant during our luteal phase. And so this all makes sense from a scientific perspective as well. And then in terms of micro dosing, she recommended that, you know, choose a protocol, whatever protocol you might follow, that could be the Fativin protocol or the Stamets stack, and continue the protocol for at least 3 months to see how that affects your menstrual cycle if you're micro dosing. And then before switching it up to a different one, if you're going to switch, because it takes about 3 months to really notice some of those effects or to really get the full picture of what those benefits might be for your specific body or specific conditions that you're dealing with. And I really liked that wisdom as well, that, it, you know, it takes time, maybe track it in a journal, that sort of thing. It could be very beneficial to you.
Wow. My mind is blown that the research that you just dropped right there. That's so fascinating. Now I'm curious, as for women who are dealing with menopause, like how does that, is there a different way to manage like the microdosing or the macrodosing?
Yeah, I think we can look at it a little differently. I mean, of course, we still have, even though our periods stop, that menstrual cycle is still going, especially through perimenopause. So we're still having the follicular phase, the ovulation, and the luteal phase. It just shifts quite a bit, and it becomes much more erratic. So if you're in perimenopause, which is that really that decade leading up to menopause, menopause is essentially when you've had an absence of a period for 1 year, so 12 months. And then after that, you're in postmenopause. So it's like menopause itself is just this blip on our radar it's a moment in time that we mark, okay, I've hit menopause, and then you're in postmenopause. But before that, you're in perimenopause. And that's when we often have the classic menopausal symptoms, such as hot flashes, depression, and things like that. So it's a little bit different, and we can approach psychedelics a little bit differently. You don't necessarily have to time it with your with the luteal phase. And I mean, it's probably a good idea to still do that, especially if you know when you're getting your period and things like that. That's helpful. But in terms of menopause, I did uncover some really good research there too, and I was excited about it. So I think one of the first things that happens for people when they get into the perimenopause trajectory there, that they often get depression. Depression is something that can crop up, even if you've never had depression before. And it has to do with the fluctuation in hormones because it becomes so erratic in perimenopause. And the first thing that you'll do if you go to your doctor is and you tell them that you're having depression and they find out you're in perimenopause, they're going to put you on a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which is it's an SSRI, and that's an antidepressant. So most of our antidepressants are SSRIs. There are other types of antidepressants out there, but those are the classic ones.
Right.
And so you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those are great medications. They've helped many, many people, but the thing to consider is that SSRIs will exacerbate other symptoms of menopause, or they can. So, for example, another classic symptom of perimenopause would be a change in your libido, and it can be a tanking of the libido. And so SSRIs, they have a side effect of blunting libido as well. And so that's a really big issue for women. And, you know, I do want to talk just briefly. I'm going to take this on a little side trip here, and I'll get back
please.
To talking about menopause, but you know, it's such a frustrating thing, the sexual dysfunction that can arise, and it can arise at any point in your life. So the statistic is that 40% of people assigned female at birth in reproductive years have 40% have female sexual dysfunction. And that goes up to about 80-85% once people are in menopause. And
wow.
So it's a pretty alarming how many women face female sexual dysfunction. And the thing to also consider is that it's something that's not talked about in the mainstream medical community. It's pretty much discounted. And I always like to back up my information with facts. So I like to throw out this timeline when I'm doing podcast interviews. And that is that in 1998, men got a drug for male sexual dysfunction. And we all know what that is. It's Viagra, right? And
right.
So household name. And at that point in time, the medical community, let alone anybody that a woman was sleeping with, didn't have a complete picture of what the clitoris looks like. There's all this internal structure to the clitoris. People think of it as just this little nub, but that's not it. That's just the tip of the iceberg, right? And so that wasn't discovered until 2005, that the clitoris had all this internal structure.
2005?
So, yeah. A female urologist did some MRI research and discovered this. And so she mapped it out. And now we finally know where the clitoris is, right?
In 2005? That's crazy to me.
Then listen to this. It wasn't until 2015 that women got a drug for female sexual dysfunction. That is a 17-year gap from when men got a drug to when women got a drug for the same condition. Even though it affects the male body and female body differently, it still matters. It matters to women. The World Health Organization says sexual health is important to overall health. You know, it's one of the most important things. I mean, not the most important thing, but it is incredibly important to our overall health. So getting back to menopause, I get really frustrated when I hear that people are just being put on SSRIs in menopause when I know that a possible side effect is that blunting of libido. But not only do SSRIs blunt your libido, potentially blunt your libido, they also blunt your mood. And so obviously that's something that many people are going for because they want to blunt those lows. But what people don't realize is that SSRIs also blunt your highs. So you don't get to lean into the joys of life as much when you're on an SSRI. Again, I think they're great medications and I don't want people to go off of their SSRIs if they're working for them. But it's and especially without talking to your doctor, but it's really important to consider if when your doctor's just doling out these prescriptions for SSRIs, and it may not be something that you absolutely need. So what we know about psilocybin is it doesn't blunt your libido, and it also does not blunt your mood. It doesn't blunt your highs and lows. In fact, research shows that instead of blunting, it actually makes you feel more okay with your highs and lows, which is really, really cool when you think about it. Like, yes, we do have ups and downs in life. So what if we felt more okay when we are down, you know, as well as when we're up, and we just feel better. And so I get really excited about that. Plus, the other thing to consider is that with an SSRI, you have to take that pretty regular, I mean, regularly every day for them to work at, you know, without having worse side effects where you have withdrawal. With psilocybin, you can typically do a macro dose and have very lasting effects for even up to a year is what research is showing us. Yep. And so, especially for depression, that's what we're learning. And so I'm really excited about that. And I'm hoping people are thinking, start to think outside of the box in terms of menopausal symptoms. Now, so can psilocybin help with sexual dysfunction in menopause? We don't know yet, but we do have some ideas here. So two things that are protective against female sexual dysfunction are having a positive body image, and then also having intimate partner communication. Now, that's not a guarantee. It's just two things that can help. Mm-hmm. And what we do know about psilocybin research so far is that psilocybin is being studied for eating disorders. And we do have clinical trials now with psilocybin for anorexia nervosa, for example, and we are seeing positive effects with body image. So this is really great.
Yeah.
And then we also know that psilocybin can facilitate intimacy in terms of that intimate partner communication. So that doesn't mean that you have to do psilocybin with your partner. You can go off and do your own journey and then come back and then feel a deeper connection to the person that you're with, just sort of automatically kind of happens that way. And so we do think that psilocybin can potentially benefit female sexual dysfunction. Now, it's not necessarily going to be some sort of classic aphrodisiac, like we think of oysters or chocolate or something like that. Psilocybin may not make you feel like getting all, you know, funky in the bedroom, but in the moment, but later it may. So after you've done your dose, and that's not to say that it won't, you know, produce that effect of making you feel a little bit more amorous in the moment. But it's just I wanted to point out that it's not a classic aphrodisiac in terms of acting that way. It just acts on different processes in your brain that could be exacerbating female sexual dysfunction. So I was really excited to learn about that. And then I know that this is a podcast about trauma, so I do want to talk about trauma and menopause a little bit.
Yeah.
So what we do know is that one in six adults have had four or more adverse childhood experiences. So to back up, adverse childhood experiences are things that were traumatic in childhood that occurred. So that could be living through abuse and neglect as a child, having parents that had a very volatile relationship and there was violence in the home or verbal abuse, having a parent who was incarcerated, living through a natural disaster, living in systemic racism in your community, facing extreme poverty, extreme childhood illness or severe childhood illness. These are all things that could have produced trauma in you as a kid. Mm-hmm. And these adverse childhood experiences, they actually physically change our stress response for the long term. And it's nothing that that you did. It's just that you faced some trauma and that changed how your body processes cortisol and glucose and things like that. Well, what we know about menopause is that if you've had, so again, one in six people have had four or more adverse childhood experiences. And if you've had four or more adverse childhood experiences, you're more likely to have worsened menopause symptoms. And that likely has to do with that altered stress response, because our stress response is also involved in hot flashes and all these other elements of menopause. And we do know now that, so research just came out this fall that I'm so excited about. It's early research, but we do know that when people use psilocybin, they report less psychological distress from their adverse childhood experiences. So I think there's a lot of potential here for people to use psilocybin in menopause, whether they're macrodosing or microdosing, to help control that stress response that we have from those adverse childhood experiences, mm-hmm. almost heal those adverse childhood experiences so that we can have potentially a better menopause trajectory. So I was really excited about that, to learn that. And then one final note on menopause and then I'll be quiet.
No, no, please. I love listening to you.
Thank you so much. So, you know, another thing that happens in menopause is you know, we have different cravings. Maybe we're turning to alcohol more often to calm some of the feelings, the uncomfortable feelings that we're having from all these hormonal shifts that we're experiencing suddenly. And so we do know that psilocybin can really help with facilitating behavior change. So I mentioned myself cutting back on drinking just sort of almost automatically. It happened after doing my macrodose. And I did some integration related to that, but really kind of leaning into that behavior change. So after you do a macrodose, you have this increased level of neuroplasticity in your brain, mm-hmm. meaning like you're growing new synapses and dendrites. It's like your brain is this flower that's totally blooming even after the psilocybin session. And so this is a great time to make behavior changes. And that could be anything that you're using to numb out, whether that's alcohol, whether that's online shopping, whether that's, you know, eating desserts too often or whatever. And all of those things can mess with menopause. And so if we can lean into some of these behavior changes, maybe we've been trying to change a behavior for all our lives and it's just coming to a head in menopause, but that increased level of neuroplasticity after doing a macrodose is a great time to do that. Plus, we know from reports of people microdosing that they've also, I mean, there's increased neuroplasticity there, and it's helped people lean into behavior change as well. So you don't have to macrodose. You can also just microdose. Okay.
That's amazing. I think it's really fascinating. Everything that you said, you know, for me, when we didn't know it was PMDD when mm-hmm. I would have these insane mood swings. I was actually extremely suicidal the day before my period would come.
I'm so sorry.
I know. It was a lot. And I didn't know that PMDD was a thing.
Sure.
And so they prescribed me Prozac for, you know, like that, you know, and I don't think they knew any better, which is really sad. I don't want to make that an excuse, because that's what general, you know, the general practice is. And when,
of course,
to just give you. And the thing is, it didn't really work, because they were like, maybe you could just take it the week before your period. And it was like, you know, and then I wouldn't have to do it, but then I'd start up again. And, you know, eventually I went and I was actually misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder when it was really trauma that I never spoke about. And I was like, I'm lithium and antipsychotics and all of the things. And I wish I knew a lot more about psychedelics. And you know, I tell the story a lot about when, you know, when I was a child and I was just doing it recreationally as a 16-year-old. And I was all I could see was this childhood sexual abuse I was enduring. And I was like, why is this happening? This is the worst experience of my life. That was my bad trip. And I would always sure. tell people I had a bad trip. And just, you know, just a few years ago, I was like, oh, that wasn't a bad trip. That was telling me that this is something that I needed to really dive into. And I unfortunately didn't realize that until a few years ago. So that was like 20 something years of my life where I was just like sitting on this secret, this, you know, thing that was happening. And I feel like that's why education is so important, and why it's so amazing that you have this handbook for women, because let's face it, we didn't know any of these things. And I'm so grateful that I need this book. And I think a lot of people need this book, because I think a lot of people are dealing with, you know, my doctor only knew to give me SSRIs. And actually, when I was on SSRIs, my hair was falling out. So that obviously did a lot for my own self-esteem and caused me more depression. So like you said, it's just, it'll affect other things. And, you know, what I've realized with psilocybin and microdosing and the macrodoses is that there are no negative side effects that I have personally experienced. Everything has been positive. Even just, you know, if you want to say, like, I don't, like, when I'm in an argument with my husband, like, before, like, I would go all in, like, I am right, and I'm going to make sure, like, now I'm like, you know what, if you think you're right, you know, I know I'm right, but I don't have to prove it to you anymore, right? So it has taught me so, so, so much. And, I'm just, I can't thank you enough for all of this information. I mean, even the whole idea, I'm still blown away about the whole idea that we didn't get like this drug for libido for so many years. I didn't realize they didn't even discover this stuff, anything about the clitoris until 2000.
I know. That's so crazy.
Yes, that's insane to me.
One of the things that I also came across in the research when I was kind of looking at the differences between the male body, the female body, and in terms of psychedelics, I was surprised to learn that in some cases, more women are using some psychedelics more frequently than men, because it just seemed like to me, I mean, this was just a bias that I had. I thought, well, men are using psychedelics more. Well, when I dug a little deeper, it made sense that more women are using, and that is because, So there's a difference between the way that men and women approach psychedelics. Men typically use psychedelics for recreational purposes. Right. I mean, that not all men, of course. This is an overgeneralization from a survey that was done, a global drug survey. But they report using it more recreationally, like going to a festival or hanging out with friends and things like that. Whereas women are turning to psychedelics to self-treat. And this is for conditions that they're not getting adequate care for in the mainstream medical system. Mm. So things like PTSD, other forms of trauma, anxiety, depression, chronic pain, menstrual cycle issues, whether that's PMDD, PCOS, or pain related to endometriosis, all of these things people are turning to psychedelics for. And again, this is because they're not getting adequate treatment in the mainstream medical system. And I'm not against the mainstream medical system. I always like to preface that. Like, I'm a science and medical journalist. I appreciate medicine so much. Appreciate the research that's coming out now about various things. But it is a problem. Women often get left behind. Plus, they're more likely to get gaslit at the doctor's office for these very conditions. Their pain is not treated seriously. Their symptoms aren't treated seriously. We're told we're hysterical. That sounds like an outdated concept, but it still happens to this day. And I've been gaslit at the doctor's office so many times. So I am not surprised that women are turning to psychedelics a little bit more. And it's just super frustrating that we've had such a lack of research on the female body. Women were largely excluded from early stage clinical trials until the 1990s. And so that timeline about Viagra to when women finally got a drug for female sexual dysfunction is a direct result of that issue, because the female body just wasn't studied. You know, now it's required that clinical trials have to have a certain number of women. And, and that's important. And I think the thing also to consider is that the world treats women as if we're minorities, as if we're a minority in the grand scheme of things, like the white male is like the mainstream, but it's not. I mean, women make up a roughly 49 to 51% of the world. And so, it's pretty important. We're very important.
We birth children, for goodness sake.
We do. Yeah, exactly.
But I do. So for like listening to all of this, and I know that there are very few doctors I know who have an idea that there's something other than SSRIs, or there's something other than, you know, just the general medical practice. How do we like set up the next generation of doctors who can treat people holistically and, you know, equally and fairly?
Yeah, I know. That's a great question. And I wish I could solve it. But what I hope, I hope that what we're doing right now, having these open conversations I know your podcast will go out to the world. And so this is important what we're doing. It's important that we're talking about it. I love that Moms on Mushrooms with Tracy T is talking about it for moms. And so we've got communities out there that are talking about it, and that's what we can certainly do. I am also a big advocate for talking to your doctor about it. I mean, now I need to clarify that psilocybin is not broadly legal. It's illegal in certain contexts in certain states and cities. So we have to be careful about that, because of course I don't want someone to go into their doctor and talk about using psilocybin, and then, you know, that doctor reports that because this person's a mom, and then reports them and then, you know, Child Protective Services is called. I don't want to encourage that, but there's nothing wrong with asking your doctor about psilocybin, not necessarily like professing your current usage, but if you want to ask your doctor about that in terms of like, well, what about if I go and do psychedelic assisted therapy or something like that, where, you know, you could say where it's legal if you want to have a conversation about right. that with your doctor. Because I think we need to be encouraging doctors to think outside the box when it comes to, you know, the conditions that just really don't have adequate treatments. And, you know, I was recently I was getting interviewed by somebody, and they asked me, well, a lot of doctors are concerned that people are just going to go to psychedelics and not take SSRIs. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with that? You right. know, I mean, are you worried about us not like pocketing lining the bank accounts of pharmaceutical companies? Is that the issue? You know, so
what was your response? Questioned,
well, they kind of just went really, they got a little shocked, like, oh, and I was like, yeah, let's think about that.
It's a legit question.
Yeah, because, you know, doctors do get kickbacks for certain things, prescribing. And so I think that's just an important consideration, is that, you know, you may not be getting the full truth from your doctor about it. And so, but I do think the more we have these open conversations, if we can, and if we feel safe doing that, you know, it's a lot easier for me as a white woman going in and talking to her doctor about it. I don't have kids, and, you know, what's the worst they can really do to me? Not much, you know? So I understand it's easy for me to say that, and not less easier for other people. And so I want to point that out, but I do want to be a staunch advocate for open conversations where people feel safe doing so, just because I do think that will further things along. And then, you know, to consider, we have a lot of research coming out now about MDMA, and I'm not an expert on MDMA like I am with psilocybin, but we are further along in the clinical trials. And I do think that MDMA will become legalized first through, like, it would be FDA approved first and then perhaps descheduled. And then I think psilocybin will follow the heels of MDMA. So I think in the next few years, we're going to see some big changes there, and we just got to hold out for those. But I know many people are not waiting, and that I'm a staunch advocate for that as well, because you have to do what is right for you and right for your body within safety context, of course.
Exactly.
You know, I want you to be safe. So.
Yes. And education is everything. So go get her book. Go get her book. I'm really, really excited. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to briefly go back to talking about those adverse childhood experiences, just because I know this, that your podcast is really rooted in talking about trauma, and that the thing I wanted to discuss was parenting. So when we've had four or more ACEs, which again, one in six adults have had four or more ACEs, our children are more than three times more likely to also have four or more ACEs. Mm-hmm. And so we know that we pass trauma down to our children. That's through literally pass it down through our genes, through epigenetics. There are studies about this, lots of research. But we also can pass it down just through like environmental aspects. So if you grew up in a very volatile household, that's your only parenting model, that maybe you may parent in a more volatile, reactionary way. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents who use psychedelics are reporting that they help them be less reactive with their kids.
Yes,
it helps
me
them
too.
Be more, more present
me
with
too.
Their kids. Yeah, that's great. And so more present with your kids as well, or that they enjoy if you have like young children and you're like, you know, they want you to get down on the floor and play Legos with them, which, let's be honest, can be really challenging when you're stressed out and you have a lot of deadlines or things that you're dealing with.
Exactly.
It helps people engage in play a little bit more. And I'm not saying that people are getting like tripping their balls out and caring for their children. That's not
right.
What I'm saying.
No, that's not what's happening.
No, it's that they're going off and doing a macro dose where they feel safe and comfortable without kids around, or, you know, it just depends on your situation, but then they're coming back and feeling that calm, or maybe they're microdosing and engaging better. So another thing that we know is protective against passing trauma down. I mean, it may not prevent that passing down through the genetics, but it can help control your own environment. Is if you have a family environment that is very like calming and you know, you're facilitating a lot of connection, that can be beneficial and protective for children against their experiencing their own traumas. So again, I see a lot of potential here for psilocybin to help with parenting and to help stop that cycle of trauma that gets passed down from generation to generation. So I just wanted to share that, since this is such a, you know, trauma focus.
No, I mean, that's amazing information. I mean, I know fact, for me, that's exactly how it has been. You know, I've experienced we lived in a very reactionary household before I went into treatment, and even a little bit after. But once I started doing my doses, my psychedelic assisted therapies, it's changed and so much. And I don't feel so stressed when the kids ask me to play with them. Sometimes that's amazing. I'm like, I'm gonna just maybe later.
Totally understandable.
But I never really played with my kids, like actively played. It was more like, what do you want me to do kind of thing.
Sure, I get that.
And so that was, yeah, I remember after my first MDMA assisted therapy, the next day it snowed and we took the kids sledding, and like my daughter asked me if I would go sledding with her, and I was like, yeah. And she was so shocked that I said yes, because I'm very much, no, you play with your friends, I'll play with my friends kind of situation.
Sure. Yeah, and of course.
Then I was just like, you know, let's walk home and let's roll a snowball and see if we can make it all the way home and see how big it is. Like, I was able to I would never have thought or even dared said it out loud, because that's definitely something I didn't want to do prior to that first experience. So it changed so much in for my family. So
I love
that.
So
effective. So thank you. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I feel like I could talk to you forever, but you will be contributing to Authentic Insider.
Yes, absolutely.
So we will have a lot of tidbits from you every month. Will. I'm so absolutely. Excited.
Yeah,
I'm
me too. Thank
so
you.
So excited about that. Well, thanks again for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. That was Jennifer Chesick, author of The Psilocybin Handbook for Women, How Magic Mushrooms, Psychedelic Therapy, and Microdosing Can Benefit Your Mental Health, Physical Health, and spiritual health. I think I went overboard with that one, but okay. Mental, physical, and spiritual health. Yeah. For more information on Jennifer and where you can purchase her book, check out the show notes. Jennifer's also going to be our monthly contributor to Authentic Insider, which you can find in the show notes as well. March's issue of Authentic Insider is out. Check out Authentic Insider at traumasurvivorthriver.com. That's traumasurvivorthriver.com, as well as past episodes of A Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the email list to get Authentic Insider in your inbox monthly. We will be back next week when I speak with Dr. Mary Jones, host of the Mary Jones podcast, for a better understanding about autism and the stigma with people of color. You've been listening to A Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. I'm Lori Lee Benstock. Thanks for being a part of the conversation. Take care.